Chapter 4. The Dark Ring. An unusual chin. A job for life, but not for long. Getting started. Fun with journalism. It's all about the city. A mile in his shoes. A lavish occasion. The man made things. He was an unsung craftsman, because the things he made never ended up with his name on them. No, they usually bore the names of dead men on them, men who were masters of their craft. He, in his turn, was the master of one craft. It was the craft of seeming.
"Do you have the money?"
"Yes," the man in the brown robe indicated the stolid troll next to him.
"Why did you bring that? Can't abide him."
$500 is a lot to carry, Mr. Morpeth, and a lot to pay for jewellery that isn't even silver, I may add," said the young man, whose name was Heretofore.
"Yes, well, that's the trick, ain't it?" said the old man. "I know this ain't exactly proper what you're doing, and I told you Stygium's rarer than gold. It just don't sparkle, well, unless you do things wrong. Believe me, I could sell all I could get to the assassins. Those fine gentlemen do like their black, so they do. They love it to bits."
"It's not illegal. No one owns a letter V. Look, we've been through this. Let me see it." The old man gave Heretofore a look, then opened a drawer and put a small box on top of his desk. He adjusted the reflectors on the lamps and said,
"Okay, open it."
The young man lifted the lid, and there it was, black as night, the serifed V a deeper, sharper shadow. He took a deep breath, reached out for the ring, and dropped it in horror. "It's warm." There was a snort from the maker of things that seemed.
"That Stygium, that is. It drinks the light. If you was out in full daylight, you'd be sucking your fingers and yelling. Keep it in a box when it's bright outside, right? Or wear a glove over it if you're a swanker."
"It's perfect."
"Yes, it is."
The old man snatched the ring back, and Heretofore began to tumble into his own private hell.
"It's just like the real thing, ain't it?" growled the seamer. "Oh, don't look surprised. You think I don't know what I've made? I've seen the real one a couple of times, and this would fool Vetinari himself. That takes a lot of forgetting."
"I don't know what you mean," Heretofore protested.
"You are stupid, then."
"I told you, no one owns the letter V."
"You'll tell that to his lordship, will you?" "No, you won't. But you'll pay me another 500. I'm thinking of return anyway, and a little extra will get me a long way away."
"We had an agreement."
"And now we're having another one," said Morpeth. "This time you're buying forgetfulness."
The maker of things that seemed beamed happily. The young man looked unhappy and uncertain.
"This is priceless to someone, right?" Morpeth prompted.
"All right, 500, damn you," said Heretofore.
"Except it's 1,000 now," said the old man. "See, you were too fast. You didn't haggle. Someone really needs my little toy, right? 1,500 all in. You try to find anyone else in this city who can work like me. And if you open your mouth to say anything but yes, it'll be 2,000. Have it my way."
There was a longer pause, and Heretofore said, "Yes, but I'll have to come back with the rest."
"You do that, mister. I'll be here waiting." "There, that wasn't too hard, was it? Nothing personal. It's just business."
The ring went back in the box. The box went back in the drawer. At a signal from the young man, the troll dropped the bags on the floor and, job done, wandered off into the night. Heretofore turned suddenly, and the seamer's right hand flew down behind the desk. It relaxed when the young man said, "You'll be here later, yes?"
"Me? I'm always here. See yourself out."
"You'll be here."
"I just said yes, didn't I?"
In the darkness of the stinking hallway, the young man opened the door, his heart thumping. A black-clad figure stepped inside. He couldn't see the face behind the mask, but he whispered, "Box is in the top left drawer. Some kind of weapon on the right side. Keep the money. Just don't hurt him, okay?"
"Hurt? That's not why I'm here," hissed the dark figure.
"I know, but do it neatly, all right?" And then Heretofore was shutting the door behind him. It was raining. He went in the doorway opposite. It was hard to hear noises over the rain and the sound of overflowing gutters, but he fancied he heard, above all this, a faint thump. It may have been his imagination, because he did not hear the door open,
or the approach of the killer, and he nearly swallowed his tongue when the man loomed in front of him, pressed the box into his hand, and vanished into the rain. A smell of peppermint drifted out onto the street. The man was Thudder, and had used a peppermint bomb to cover his scent. "You stupid, stupid old fool," heretofore said in the turmoil of his skull. "Why didn't you take the money and shut up? I had no choice. He wouldn't risk you telling anyone." Heretofore felt his stomach heave. He'd never meant it to be like this. He'd never meant for anyone to die. Then he threw up. That was last week. Things hadn't got any better. Lord Vetinari has a black coach. Other people also have black coaches. Therefore, not everyone in a black coach is Lord Vetinari. It was an important philosophical insight that Moist, to his regret, had forgotten in the heat of the moment. There was no heat now. Cosmo Lavish was cool, or at least making a spirited effort to be so. He wore black, of course, as people do to show how rich they are, but the real giveaway was the beard. It was technically a goatee, similar to that of Lord Vetinari. A thin line of black hair came down each cheek, made a detour to loop equally thinly under the nose, and met in a black triangle just below the lip, thus giving what Cosmo must have thought was a look of menacing elegance. And, indeed, on Vetinari it did. On Cosmo the elegant facial topiary floated unhappily on blue jowls, glistening with little tiny beads of sweat, and gave the effect of a pubic chin. Some master barber had to deal with it, hair by hair, every day, and his job wouldn't have been made any easier by the fact that Cosmo had inflated somewhat since the day he adopted the style. There is a time in a thoughtless young man's life when his six-pack becomes a keg, but in Cosmo's case, he had tub of larded. And then you saw the eyes, and they made up for everything. They had the faraway look of a man who can already see you dead. But probably not those of a killer himself, Moist hazarded. He probably bought death when he needed it. True, on fingers that were slightly too pudgy for them were ostensibly knobbly poison rings, but surely anyone really in the business wouldn't have so many, would they? Real killers didn't bother to advertise. And why was the elegant black glove on the other hand? That was an Assassin's Guild affectation. Yep, guild school trained then. Lots of upper-class kids went there for the education, but didn't do the black syllabus. He probably had a note from his mother saying he was excused from stabbing. Mr. Fusspot was trembling with fear, or perhaps rage. In Moist's arms he was growling like a leopard.
"Ah, my stepmother's little dog," said Cosmo as the coach began to move. "How sweet! I do not waste words. I will give you $10,000 for him, Mr. Lipvig."
He held out a piece of paper in the ungloved hand.
"My note of hand for the money. Anyone in this city will accept it."
The voice of Cosmo was a kind of modulated sigh, as if talking was somehow painful. Moist read, "Please pay the sum of $10,000 to Moist von Lipvig," and it was signed, across a one-penny stamp, by Cosmo Lavish, with many a flourish. Signed across a stamp. Where had that come from? But you saw it more and more in the city, and if you asked anyone why, they said, "'Cause it makes it legal, see?" And it was cheaper than lawyers, and so it worked. And here it was, $10,000 pointing directly at him. How dare he try to bribe me, thought Moist. In fact, that was his second thought, that of the soon-to-be wearer of a goldish chain. His first thought, courtesy of the old Moist, was, how dare he try to bribe me so small? No, he said. Anyway, I'll get more than that for looking after him for a few months.
Ah, yes, but my offer is less risky.
You think? Cosmo smiled.
Come now, Mr. Lipvig, we're men of the world.
You and I, yes, Moist finished. That's so predictable. Besides, you should have offered me more money first. At this point, something happened in the vicinity of Cosmo's forehead. Both eyebrows began to twist like Mr. Fusspot's when he was puzzled. They writhed for a moment, and then Cosmo saw Moist's expression, whereupon he slapped his brow, and his momentary glare indicated that instant death would reward any comment. He cleared his throat and said,
"For what I can get free, we are making a very good case that my stepmother was insane when she made that will."
"She seemed sharp as a tack to me, sir," said Moist.
"With two loaded crossbows on her desk."
"Ah, I see your point.
Yes, if she was really sane, she'd have hired a couple of trolls with big, big clubs.
Cosmo gave Moist a long, appraising look, or what he clearly thought was one, but Moist knew that tactic. It was supposed to make the lookee think they were being weighed up for a serious kicking, but it could just as easily mean, I'll give him the old hard eyeball while I'm wondering what to do next. Cosmo might be a ruthless man, but he wasn't a stupid one. A man in a gold suit gets noticed, and someone would remember whose coach he got into.
"I fear that my stepmother has landed you into a lot of trouble," said Cosmo.
"I've been in trouble before," said Moist.
"Oh, when was that?"
And this came sharp and sudden. Ah, the past. Not a good place to go. Moist tried to avoid it.
"Very little is known about you, Mr. Lipvig," Cosmo went on. "You were born in Uberwald, and you became our postmaster general. In between—"
"I've managed to survive," said Moist.
"An enviable achievement indeed," said Cosmo.
He tapped on the side of the coach, and it began to slow.
"I trust it will continue. In the meantime, let me at least give you this."
He tore the bill in half, and dropped the half that very emphatically did not carry his seal or signature onto Moist's lap.
"What is this for?" said Moist, picking it up while trying to restrain the frantic Mr. Fusspot with the other hand.
"Oh, just a declaration of good faith," said Cosmo as the coach stopped. "One day you might feel inclined to ask me for the other half. But understand me, Mr. Lipvig, I don't usually take the trouble to do things the hard way."
"Don't bother to do so on my account, please," said Moist, wrenching the door open. Sator Square was outside, full of carts and people and embarrassingly potential witnesses. For a moment, Cosmo's forehead did that eyebrow thing again. He gave it a slap and said,
"Mr. Lipvig, you misunderstand. This was the hard way. Goodbye. My regards to your young lady."
Moist spun on the cobbles, but the door had slammed shut and the coach was speeding away.
"Why didn't you add, 'We know where your children will go to school,'" he shouted after it.
What now? Hell's bells. He had been dropped right in it. A little way up the street, the palace beckoned. Vetinari had some questions to answer. How had the man arranged it? The watch said she'd died of natural causes. But he'd been trained as an assassin, yes? A real one, specializing in poisons, maybe. He strode in through the open gates, but the guards stopped him at the building itself. Moist knew them of old. There was probably an entrance exam for them. If they answered the question, "What is your name?" and got it wrong, they were hired. There were trolls that could outthink them. But you couldn't fool them, or talk them round. They had a list of people who could walk right in, and another of people who needed an appointment. If you weren't on either, you didn't get in. However, one of their captains, bright enough to read large type, did recognise Postmaster General and Chairman of the Royal Bank, and sent one of the lads knuckling off to see Drumknot, carrying a scribbled note. To Moist's surprise, 10 minutes later, he was being ushered into the oblong office. Seats around the big conference table at one end of the room were fully occupied. Moist recognised a few guild leaders, but quite a few were average-looking citizens, working men, men who looked ill at ease indoors. Maps of the city were strewn across the table. He'd interrupted something. Or rather, Vetinari had interrupted something for him. Lord Vetinari got up as soon as Moist entered and beckoned him forward.
"Please excuse me, ladies, gentlemen, but I do need some time with the Postmaster General. Drumknot, do take everyone through the figures again, will you? Mr. Lipvig, this way, if you please."
Moist thought he heard muffled laughter behind them as he was ushered into what he at first thought was a high-ceilinged corridor, but which turned out to be a sort of an art gallery. Vetinari shut the door behind them. The click seemed, to Moist, to be very loud. His anger was draining fast to be replaced by a very chilly feeling. Vetinari was a tyrant, after all. If Moist was never seen again, his lordship's authority could only increase.
"Do put down Mr. Fusspot," said Vetinari. "It will do the little chap good to run about."
Moist lowered the dog to the ground. It was like dropping a shield. And now he could take in what it was this gallery exhibited. What he'd thought were carved stone busts were faces made of wax. And Moist knew how and when they were made, too. They were death masks.
"My predecessors," said Vetinari, strolling down the gallery. "Not a complete collection, of course. In some cases the head could not be found,
or was, as you might say, in a rather untidy state. There was a silence. Foolishly, Moist filled it.
It must be strange, having them look down on you every day, he managed.
Who do you think, sir? I have to say, I'd rather look down on them. Gross men, for the most part. Greedy, venal, and clumsy. Cunning can do duty for thought up to a point, and then you die. Most of them died rich, fat, and terrified. They left the city the worse for their incumbency and the better for their death. But now the city works, Mr. Lipwig. We progress. We would not do so if the ruler was the kind of man who would kill elderly ladies, do you understand?
I never said...
I know exactly what you never said. You refrained from saying it very loudly. Vetinari raised an eyebrow. I am extremely angry, Mr. Lipwig.
But I've been chopped right in it.
Not by me, said Vetinari. I can assure you that if I had, as your ill-assumed street patois has it, dropped you in it, you would fully understand all meanings of drop, and have an unenviable knowledge of it.
You know what I mean.
Dear me, is this the real Moist von Lipwig speaking, or is it just the man looking forward to his very nearly gold chain? Topsy Lavish knew she was going, and simply changed her will. I salute her for it. The staff will accept you more easily, too. And she's done you a great favour.
Favour? I was shot at.
That was just the Assassin's Guild, dropping you a note to say they are watching you.
There were two shots.
Possibly for emphasis, said Vetinari, sitting down on a velvet-covered chair.
Look, banking is supposed to be dull. Numbers, pensions, a job for life.
For life, possibly, but apparently not for long, said Vetinari, clearly enjoying this.
Can't you do something?
About Cosmo Lavish, why should I? Offering to buy a dog is not illegal.
But the whole family is... How did you know that? I didn't tell you.
Vetinari waved a hand dismissively. Know the man, know the method. I know Cosmo. In this sort of situation, he will not resort to force if money will work. He can be very personable when he wants to be.
But I've heard about the rest of them. They sound a pretty poisonous bunch.
I couldn't possibly comment. However, Topsy has helped you there. The Assassin's Guild won't take out a second contract on you. Conflict of interest, you see. I suppose, technically, they could accept a contract on the chairman, but I doubt if they will. Killing a lapdog, it would not look good on anyone's resume.
I didn't sign up to deal with something like this.
No, Mr. Lipwig, you signed up to die, snapped Vetinari, his voice suddenly as cold and deadly as a falling icicle. You signed up to be justly hanged by the neck until dead for crimes against the city, against the public good, against the trust of man for man, and you were resurrected because the city required you to be.
This is about the city, Mr. Lipwig.
It is always about the city. You know, of course, that I have plans.
It was in the Times, the undertaking. You want to build roads and drains and streets under the city. There's some dwarf machine we've got hold of called a device, and the dwarfs can make waterproof tunnels. The Artificers Guild is very excited about it all.
I gather by your sombre tones that you are not? Moist shrugged. Engines of any sort had never interested him. I don't think much about it one way or another.
Astonishing, said Vetinari, taken aback.
Well, Mr. Lipwig, you can at least guess at what we will need in very large amounts for this project.
Shovels?
Finance, Mr. Lipwig. And I would have it if we had a banking system suitable for the times. I have every confidence in your ability to shake things up a little.
Moist tried one last throw.
The post office needs me, he began. At the moment it does not, and you chafe at the thought, said Vetinari. You are not a man for the humdrum. I hereby grant you leave of absence. Mr. Grote has been your deputy, and while he may not have your flair, let us say, he will, I am sure, keep things moving along.
He stood up, indicating that the audience was at an end.
The city bleeds, Mr. Lipwig, and you are the clot I need. Go away and make money.
unlock the wealth of Ankh Morpork. Mrs. Lavish gave you the bank in trust. Run it well. It's the dog that's got the bank, you know. And what a trusting little face he has, said Vetinari, ushering Moist to the door. Don't let me detain you, Mr. Lipwig. Remember, it's all about the city.
There was another protest march going on when Moist walked to the bank. You got more and more of them lately. It was a funny thing, but everyone seemed to want to live under the despotic rule of the tyrannical Lord Vetinari. They poured into the city, whose streets were apparently paved with gold. It wasn't gold, but the influx was having an effect, no doubt about it. Wages were falling, to start with. This march was against the employment of golems, who uncomplainingly did the dirtiest jobs, worked around the clock, and were so inhumanly honest they paid their taxes. But they weren't human, and they had glowing eyes, and people could get touchy about that sort of thing. Mr. Bent must have been waiting behind a pillar. Moist was no sooner through the doors of the bank, Mr. Fusspot tucked happily under his arm, when the chief cashier was by his side. "The staff are a concern, sir," he said, piloting Moist toward the stairs. "I took the liberty of telling them that you would speak to them later." Moist was aware of the worried stares, and of other things, too, now that he was looking with an almost proprietorial eye. Yes, the bank had been built well, out of fine materials, but get past that and you could see the neglect and the marks of time. It was like the now inconveniently large house of a poor old widow who just couldn't see the dust anymore. The brass was rather tarnished, the red velvet curtains frayed and a little bald in places. The marble floor was only erratically shiny. "What?" he said. "Oh, yes, good idea. Can you get this place cleaned up?" "Sir?" "The carpets are mucky, the plush ropes are unravelled, the curtains have seen better centuries, and the brass needs a jolly good scrub. The bank should look smart, Mr. Bent. You might give money to a beggar, but you wouldn't lend it to him, eh?" Bent's eyebrows rose. "And that's the chairman's view, is it?" he said. "The chairman? Oh, yes. Mr. Fusspot's very keen on clean. Isn't that right, Mr. Fusspot?" Mr. Fusspot stopped growling at Mr. Bent long enough to bark a couple of times. "See?" said Moist. "When you don't know what to do, comb your hair and clean your shoes. Words of wisdom, Mr. Bent. Jump to it. I shall elevate myself to the best of my ability, sir," said Bent. "Meanwhile, a young lady has called, sir. She seemed reluctant to give her name, but said you would be pleased to see her. I have ushered her into the small boardroom." "Did you have to open a window?" said Moist, hopefully. "No, sir." That ruled out Adora Bell, then, to replace her with a horrifying thought. "She's not one of the Lavish family, is she?" "No, sir. And it's time for Mr. It's time for the chairman's lunch, sir. He has cold-boned chicken because of his stomach. I'll have it sent along to the small boardroom, shall I?" "Yes, please. Could you rustle up something for me?" "Rustle, sir?" Bent looked puzzled. "You mean steal?" "Ah, that kind of man," Moist thought. "I meant find me something to eat," he translated. "Certainly, sir. There is a small kitchen in the suite, and we have a chef on call. Mrs. Lavish has lived here for some time. It will be interesting to have a master of the Royal Mint again." "I like the sound of master of the Royal Mint," Moist said. "How about that, Mr. Fusspot?" On cue, the chairman barked. "Hmm," said Bent. "One final thing, sir. Could you please sign these?" He indicated a pile of paperwork. "What are they?" "They're not minutes, are they? I don't do minutes." "They are various formalities, sir. Basically, they add up to you signing a receipt for the bank on the chairman's behalf. But I am advised that Mr. Fusspot's paw mark should appear in the places ticked." "Does he have to read all this?" said Moist. "No, sir." "Then I won't. It's a bank. You've given me the big tour. It's not as though it's got a wheel missing. Just show me where to sign. Just here, sir. And here. And here. And here, and here, and here, and here." The lady in the conference room was certainly an attractive woman, but since she worked for the Times, Moist felt unable to award her total ladylike status. Ladies didn't fiendishly quote exactly what you said, but didn't exactly mean, or hit you around the ear with unexpectedly difficult questions. Well, come to think of it, they did, quite often, but she got paid for it. But he had to admit, Saccharissa Cripslock was fun. "Saccharissa,
"This is a should-have-been-expected surprise," he declared as he stepped into the room.
"Mr. Lipwig, always a pleasure," said the woman. "So you are a dog's body now?"
"That kind of fun. A bit like juggling knives. You were instantly on your toes. It was as good as a workout." "Writing the headlines already, Saccharissa," he said. "I am merely carrying out the terms of Mrs. Lavish's will." He put Mr. Fussbot on the polished tabletop and sat down.
"So, you are now chairman of the bank?"
"No, Mr. Fusspot here is the chairman," said Moist. "Bark circumspectly at the nice lady with the busy pencil, Mr. Fusspot." "Woof," said Mr. Fusspot.
"Mr. Fusspot is the chairman," said Saccharissa, rolling her eyes. "Of course. And you take orders from him, do you?"
"Yes. I am master of the Royal Mint, by the way."
"A dog and his master," said Saccharissa. "How nice. And I expect you can read his thoughts because of some mystic bond between dog and man?"
"Saccharissa, I could not have put it better." They smiled at each other. This was only round one. Both knew they were barely warming up.
"So, I take it that you would not agree with those who say that this is one last ruse by the late Mrs. Lavish to keep the bank out of the hands of the rest of her family, believed by some to be totally incapable of running it anywhere but further into the ground? Or would you confirm the opinion of many that the patrician has every intention of bringing the city's uncooperative banking industry to heel and finds in this situation the perfect opportunity?"
"Some who believe..." "Those who say? Who are these mysterious people?" said Moist, trying to raise an eyebrow as good as Vetinari's. "And how is it that you know so many of them?" Saccharissa sighed.
"And you wouldn't describe Mr. Fusspot as really little more than a convenient sock puppet?"
"Woof," said the dog at the mention of his name.
"I find the very question offensive," said Moist.
"And so does he."
"Moist, you are just no fun any more." Saccharissa closed her notebook. "You're talking like, well, like a banker."
"I'm glad you think so. Remember, just because she shut the notebook doesn't mean you can relax."
"No dashing around on mad stallions? Nothing to make us cheer? No wild dreams?" said Saccharissa.
"Well, I'm already tidying up the foyer."
Saccharissa's eyes narrowed.
"Tidying the foyer? Who are you? And what have you done with the real Moist von Lipwig?"
"No, I'm serious. We have to clean up ourselves before we can clean up the economy," said Moist, and felt his brain shift seductively into a higher gear. "I intend to throw out what we don't need. For example, we have a room full of useless metal in the vault. That'll have to go."
Saccharissa frowned.
"Are you talking about the gold?
Where had that come from?"
"Well, don't try to back away, or she'll go for the throat. Tough it out. Besides, it's good to see her looking astonished."
"Yes," he said.
"You can't be serious."
The notebook was instantly flipped open, and Moist's tongue began to gallop. He couldn't stop it. It would have been nice if it had talked to him first. Taking over his brain, it said, "Dead serious. I am recommending to Lord Vetinari that we sell it all to the dwarfs. We do not need it. It's a commodity and nothing more."
"But what's worth more than gold?"
"Practically everything. You, for example. Gold is heavy. Your weight in gold is not very much gold at all. Aren't you worth more than that?"
Saccharissa looked momentarily flustered to Moist's glee.
"Well, in a manner of speaking..."
"The only manner of speaking worth talking about," said Moist flatly. "The world is full of things worth more than gold. But we dig the damn stuff up and then bury it in a different hole. Where's the sense in that? What are we, magpies? Is it all about the gleam? Good heavens, potatoes are worth more than gold. Surely not. If you were shipwrecked on a desert island, what would you prefer, a bag of potatoes or a bag of gold?"
"Yes, but a desert island isn't Ankh Morpork."
"And that proves gold is only valuable because we agree it is, right? It's just a dream. But a potato is always worth a potato, anywhere. Add a knob of butter and a pinch of salt, and you've got a meal. Anywhere. Bury gold in the ground, and you'll be worrying about thieves forever. Bury a potato, and in due season you could be looking at a dividend of 1,000%.
"Can I assume, for a moment, that you don't intend to put us on the potato standard?" said Saccharissa sharply.
Moist smiled. "No, it won't be that. But in a few days I shall be giving away money. It doesn't like to stand still, you know. It likes to get out and make new friends." The bit of Moist's brain that was trying to keep up with his mouth thought, "I wish I could make notes about this. I'm not sure I can remember it all."
but the conversations of the last day were banging together in his memory and making a kind of music. He wasn't sure he had all the notes yet, but there were bits he could hum. He just had to listen to himself for long enough to find out what he was talking about.
"By giving away, you mean," said Saccharissa,
"hand over. Make a gift of."
"Seriously? How? Why?"
"All in good time."
"You are smirking at me, Moist."
"No, I've frozen because I've just heard what my mouth said," Moist thought. "I don't have a clue. I've just got some random thoughts. It's
about desert islands," he said, "and why this city isn't one."
"And that's it?" Moist rubbed his forehead. "Miss Cripslock. Miss Cripslock. This morning I got up with nothing in mind but to seriously make headway with the paperwork and maybe lick the problem of that special 25p cabbage green stamp. You know, the one that'll grow into a cabbage if you plant it. How can you expect me to come up with a new fiscal initiative by tea time?"
"All right, but it'll take me at least until breakfast."
He saw her write that down. Then she tucked the notebook in her handbag.
"This is going to be fun, isn't it?" she said,
and Moist thought, "Never trust her when she's put her notebook away, either. She's got a good memory. Seriously, I think this is an opportunity for me to do something big and important for my adopted city," said Moist, in his sincere voice.
"That's your sincere voice," she said.
"Well, I'm being sincere," said Moist.
"But since you raised the subject, Moist, what were you doing with your life before the citizens of Ankh-Morpork greeted you with open palms?"
"Surviving," said Moist. "In Überwald, the old empire was breaking up. It was not unusual for a government to change twice over lunch. I worked at anything I could to make a living. By the way, I think you meant arms back there," he added.
"And when you got here, you impressed the gods so much that they led you to a treasure trove so that you could rebuild our post office."
"I'm very humble about that," said Moist, trying to look it.
"Yes. And the gods-given gold was all in used coinage from the plain cities."
"You know what? I've often lain awake wondering about that myself," said Moist, "and I reached the conclusion that the gods, in their wisdom, decided that the gift should be instantly negotiable." "I can go on like this for as long as you like," he thought, "and you're trying to play poker with no cards. You can suspect all you like, but I gave that money back. Okay, I stole it in the first place, but giving it back counts for something, doesn't it? The slate is clean, isn't it? Well, acceptably grubby, yes?" The door opened slowly, and a young and nervous woman crept in, holding a plate of cold boned chicken. Mr. Fusspot brightened up as she placed it in front of him. "Sorry, can we get you a coffee or something?" said Moist, as the girl headed back toward the door. Saccharissa stood up. "Thank you, but no. I'm on a deadline, Mr. Litvig. I'm sure we'll be talking again very soon."
"I'm certain of it, Miss Cripslock," said Moist.
She took a step toward him and lowered her voice.
"Do you know who that girl was?"
"No, I hardly know anyone yet."
"So you don't know if you can trust her?"
"Trust her?"
Saccharissa sighed. "This is not like you, Moist. She's just given a plate of food to the most valuable dog in the world, a dog that some people might like to see dead."
"Why shouldn't—" Moist began. They both turned to Mr. Fusspot, who was already licking the empty plate up the length of the table with an appreciative grumph-grumph noise.
"Can you see yourself out?" said Moist, hurrying toward the sliding plate. "If you're in any doubt, stick your fingers down his throat," said Saccharissa from the door, with what Moist considered an inappropriate amount of amusement.
He grabbed the dog and hurried through the far door after the girl. It led to a narrow and not particularly well-decorated corridor with a green door at the end from which came the sound of voices. Moist barged through it. In the small, neat kitchen beyond, a tableau greeted him. The young woman was backed against a table, and a bearded man in a white suit was wielding a big knife. They looked shocked.
"What's going on?" Moist yelled. You just ran through the door and shouted," said the girl. "Was something wrong? I always give Mr. Fusspot his appetizer about now."
"And I'm doing his entree," said the man, bringing the knife down on a tray of offal. "It's chicken neck stuffed with giblets, with his special toffee pudding for afters. And who's asking?"
I'm
his owner," said Moist, as haughtily as he could manage. The chef removed his white hat.
"Sorry, sir, of course you are. The gold suit and everything. This is Peggy, my daughter. I'm Amesbury, sir."
Moist had managed to calm down a little. "Sorry," he said. "I was just worried that someone might try to poison Mr. Fusspot."
"We were just talking about that," said Amesbury. "I thought that—" "Hold on, you don't mean me, do you?"
No, certainly not, said Moist, to the man still holding a knife.
Well, all right, said Amesbury, mollified. You're new, sir, you're not to know. That Cosmo kicked Mr. Fusspot once.
He'd poison anyone, he would, said Peggy.
But I go down to the market every day, sir, and select the little dog's food myself. And it's stored downstairs in the cool room, and I have the only key.
Moist relaxed. You couldn't knock out an omelette for me, could you? He said. The chef looked panicky.
That's eggs, right? He said nervously. Never really got involved with cooking eggs, sir. He has a raw one in his steak tartare on Fridays, and Mrs. Lavish used to have two raw ones in her gin and orange juice every morning, and that is about it between me and eggs. I've got a pig's head sousing, if you fancy some of that. Got tongue, hearts, marrow bone, sheep's head, nice bit of dewlap, melts, slaps, lights, liver, kidneys, beckles.
In his youth, Moist had been served a lot off that menu. It was exactly the sort of food that one should serve to kids if one wanted them to grow up skilled in the arts of barefaced lying, sleight of hand, and camouflage. As a matter of course, Moist had hidden those strange wobbly meats under his vegetables, on one occasion achieving a potato 12 inches high. Light dawned. "Did you cook much for Mrs. Lavish?" said Moist.
"No, sir. She lived on gin, vegetable soup, her morning pick-me-up, and—"
"Gin," said Peggy firmly. "So you're basically a dog chef?"
"Canine, sir, if it's all the same to you. You may have read my book, Cooking with Brains." Amesbury said this rather hopelessly, and rightly so.
"Unusual path to follow," said Moist.
"Well, sir, it enables me to... it's safer. Well, the truth is, I have an allergy, sir."
The chef sighed.
"Show him, Peggy."
The girl nodded and pulled a grubby card out of her pocket. "Please, don't say this word, sir," she said, and held it up. Moist stared.
"You just can't avoid it in the catering business, sir," said Amesbury miserably.
This wasn't the time, really wasn't the time. But if you weren't interested in people, then you didn't have the heart of a trickster. "You're allergic to this stuff," he said, correcting himself just in time.
"No, sir. The word, sir. I can handle the actual allium in question. I can even eat it. But the sound of it, well..."
Moist looked at the word again and shook his head sadly.
"So I have to shun restaurants, sir."
"I can see that. How are you with the word leek?"
"Yes, sir, I know where you're going. I've been there. Far leek. Tar lick. No effect at all."
"Just garlic, then. Oh, sorry." Amesbury froze, with a distant expression on his face. "Gods, I'm so sorry. I honestly didn't mean—" Moist began. "I know," said Peggy wearily. "The word just forces its way out, doesn't it? He'll be like this for 15 seconds, then he'll throw the knife straight ahead of him. Then he'll speak in fluent Quermian for about 4 seconds. Then he'll be fine. Here," she handed Moist a bowl containing a large brown lump. "You go back in there with a sticky toffee pudding, and I'll hide in the pantry. I'm used to it, and I can do you an omelette, too." She pushed Moist through the door and shut it behind him. He put down the bowl to the immediate and fully focused interest of Mr. Fusspot. Watching a dog try to chew a large piece of toffee is a pastime fit for gods. Mr. Fusspot's mixed ancestry had given him a dexterity of jaw that was truly awesome. He somersaulted happily around the floor, making faces like a rubber gargoyle in a washing machine. After a few seconds, Moist distinctly heard the twang of a knife vibrating in woodwork, followed by a scream of,
"Nom d'un bouillard, pourquoi est-ce que je suis à de mon riz sous capa par les dieux?"